The children of Israel have turned from the border of the promised land and have now re-entered the wilderness. As the day's travel ends, it is the sons of Kohath, themselves Levites, who carry the covered furnishings of the tabernacle into the middle of the camp and lay them down. And here their duty ends, for it is only the sons of Aaron who are to uncover the furnishings and set up the tabernacle. As he carefully unburdens his load, one of the sons of Kohath pauses as the sons of Aaron commence their careful work. He waits and he watches. Soon, however, the outer court of the tabernacle begins to be raised, and he is soon forced to leave quickly, lest his presence profane the sacred ground. Only the sons of Aaron may enter this place. And yet, for a while, he continues to watch even from outside the court, until the work is finished and the familiar smoke of the evening sacrifice rises above the linen walls of the court of the tabernacle of the congregation. Korah proceeds to his own tent slowly, thinking to himself, thinking of the tabernacle of the congregation. That night, he shares his concerns with his wife and his sons, but they seem less aware of these crucial issues than he himself is. He finds a more understanding audience among a few of the sons of Reuben, whose tribe is camped on the same side of the tabernacle as his. Over the next few days, he visits these men often. Though a Levite, he is not a priest, and his presence will not personally be required until the furnishings of the tabernacle need fetching and carrying once more. One night, a meeting is held. A number of influential men are there to hear Sheriff Korah share his concerns. He is a devout man and loves his God fervently. Speaking comes naturally to him, and he quotes from the law with skill. His thoughts are disturbing, and his questions challenging. Who is our leader? Is it not Yahweh, our God? Has he not promised to lead us to a land of promise, flowing with milk and honey? Why do we wander in this wilderness? Is it not because of the decision of Moses, who rejected the call of the entire congregation to enter the land of Canaan, promised by their God? There was a time when Moses judged only the minority of cases, when a large council of elders, men we knew and could trust, gave judgment. And there was a time when our God spoke to us. And now it seems that all we hear is Moses, and only Aaron and his sons have the privilege of standing in the presence of God. We are led by a man who spurns the promises of our God and a priesthood which keeps him separated from us. We must return our God to his people. Did he not say that all the people were holy? Did he not say that he would dwell among us? Is not the sign of his presence the tabernacle of the congregation? Not the tabernacle of Moses, not the tabernacle of Aaron. Our people have been separated too long from their God by meaningless ritual and dull ordinance. We must return him to his people. Our families will be killed in this wilderness by Moses. He leads us further from the land of promise each day. There are times when God demands that his true followers act on his behalf. We must rid ourselves of the dictatorship of Moses and the corrupt priesthood of Aaron. Remember our aim. We do this not for ourselves, but for our people and for our God. We must lead our people to the land of promise and return their God to them. We must take the leadership and reform the people. In order to reform the people, we must first reform the priesthood. The people will follow when they see that God is with us. We must reform the priesthood. We personally are first confronted with Korah himself in Numbers 16, but Korah has been around for a number of years, but he's been out of sight, preparing for this moment. At this time, the people are disillusioned and they are frustrated with their inability to enter the land of promise. However, as always, they do not want to take responsibility for that failure. They want a scapegoat for their actions and a leader to take future responsibility for them. And they are also, unfortunately, ignorant. Let's consider now the character of Korah in his own words. The character of Korah as he expressed himself to Moses and to the congregation. In Numbers 16, verse 3, we find, I believe, the character of Korah as expressed to Moses and the congregation. In essence, he says he is a man of God. He wants all the congregation to serve their God. He is a man of humility, but he believes that Moses and Aaron have lifted themselves above all others, that the people are being kept from their God by these men. He does not want power. He simply wants the people to be united with their God. How was Moses to respond to this challenge? Korah had been drawing support for weeks. But perhaps this was the first that Moses knew of it. He had no record of what Korah had been saying, no knowledge of his arguments. He had nothing he could take hold of and refute point by point. The moment had come and was upon him. Yet Moses knew that Korah was a dishonest man and had been deliberately representing not only God, but also Moses and Aaron. He could think back over the past few weeks and imagine the process. There would have been subtle hints about the integrity of Moses and Aaron. Sly comments, veiled criticisms, questions with double meanings. A careful campaign waged silently, undercover, intent on pulling these men down without them being able to respond. Perhaps Moses had known that such comments were being made, but what could he do? To confront these men would have resulted in complete denial, and the people would have branded him a troublemaker, paranoid, suspicious, and obsessed with maintaining his own position. Yet how many times did Moses have to go through this? How many times would Moses have awoken in the morning thinking to himself, "I wonder who's thinking what today? I wonder what they're saying about me today." But now it was all in the open. And now was the moment of truth. How was Moses to determine what this man Korah really wanted? What his character was really like? And how was he to show this to the congregation? Moses had only one weapon, but he used it well. It was the sword of the Spirit. By comparing the actions of Korah and his men with the principles of Scripture, their characters would be known. In Proverbs 20, verse 11, we read, "Even a child is known by his doings, whether his work be pure and whether it be right." In Matthew 7, Christ warns, "Beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. Ye shall know them by their fruits." In James chapter 2, verse 13, "Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of good behavior his works with meekness of wisdom." It was the works of Korah and his followers which would prove their meekness and their wisdom. This was the test which Moses had to put. Are the actions of Korah the actions of a godly man? Let us consider the actions of Korah and consider them against his own claims. Is Korah a humble man? Turn to Isaiah 57, verse 15. Now, Isaiah 57, verse 15, we find the crucial principle of humility and the manner in which we are able to approach God by means of it. Isaiah 57, verse 15. "For thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones. Did Yahweh speak and dwell with Korah? Let's turn back to number 16. In number 16 we find 2 days in which the presence of God was very much among his people. And quite obviously so. And yet he was remarkably selective as to who he spoke to. In number 16, verse 3, Korah believes that Moses and Aaron take too much upon themselves. He believes that Yahweh is among all the congregation. And yet there is an element of truth in what he says. But what he does not understand is that it is not Aaron and Moses who speak to Yahweh, but Yahweh who chooses to speak to them. And if Korah had thought about this, he would have known why. Have a look at the attitude of Moses expressed in number 16. Let's compare his character with that of Korah. In number 16, verse 4, Moses falls upon his face. In verses 20 to 23, he falls upon his face before his God again, and his God speaks to him. In verse 36, Yahweh came and spoke again to Moses. In verses 44 to 45, Yahweh spoke again to Moses. Why is it that God continually spoke to this man? It was because he lived and presented himself to his God in a manner which was acceptable. Of all the men upon the earth, there was no man more meek than Moses. Moses humbled himself continually before his God. And this was the attitude which God sought from those who served him. And this was the reason why it was that God spoke to Moses and not to Korah. But why, in verses 21 and 45, why do we find Moses and Aaron curiously disobeying a commandment of God? In verse 21, we find God speaking to Moses and Aaron and saying, "Separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." And likewise, in verse 45, "Get you up from this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." In both instances, we find Moses and Aaron on their faces, prostrate in humility before their God. Why was it that Moses and Aaron did not separate themselves from the congregation to allow God to destroy them all? It was because they recognized themselves as being no better than the rest. Both of these men expressed by their actions as well as by their words the humility which God requires of those who truly serve him. And this explains to us the close relationship which God had with Moses and Aaron and the complete lack of relationship which God had with Korah. Let's further consider Korah's character and his claims. Was he really disinterested in power? Was he only thinking of the congregation? Let's read verse 1. Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, and Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with certain of the children of Israel, 250 princes of the assembly, famous in the congregation, men of renown. Why did Korah have 250 rulers, famous men, men of renown? And why did he bring them in his confrontation with Moses? This is a raw, overwhelming display of force. There is nothing humble in Korah's attitude. Moreover, there is a very clear indication that Korah, when he wants something done, gets it done with force. There's no room for debate as far as Korah is concerned. There is nothing of the spirit of Matthew 5, verses 24 to 25, the spirit of reconciliation between brethren. Korah was not the kind of man whom, if he had a problem with his brother, would approach him quietly, speak to him one-on-one, and so return his brother to him and gain his brother. No, Korah was interested in one thing, and it was not reconciliation, it was power. Undoubtedly, these men were taken from among the tribes. Quite probably, they represented a broad cross-section of the people who supported Korah and his aims. They represented widespread support. And standing behind Korah, they represented power. Moses sees this and reads Korah's character immediately. In verse 9, he says to Korah, "Seemeth it but a small thing unto you that the God of Israel hath separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself to do the service of the tabernacle of Yahweh and to stand before the congregation to minister unto them?" He is speaking directly to Korah here, and only Korah, though Dathan and Abiram were not here at the moment. Not only that, but they were not sons of Levi, nor sons of Kohath. He's speaking to Korah. "Is this such a small thing, the service of God? Is that a small thing in your eyes, Korah? You're not content with the service of God. You want the praise of men, and you want rulership over them. He hath brought thee near to him, and all thy brethren, the sons of Levi, with thee. And seek ye the priesthood also?" Is it that Korah feels so isolated because, although a Levite, he is not a priest and cannot stand within the tabernacle to do the priestly duties? Does he feel isolated because his role is only to pack up and to bear the furnishings of the tabernacle after they have been wrapped by the priests? Moses reminds him that all thy brethren are the sons of Levi, not just the sons of Aaron. The Levites were, as a tribe, separated from the other, from the rest of the tribes, from the rest of the congregation. They were brethren because they held the same responsibility. They were, as it were, men of like precious faith. And this ought to have bound them together. But instead, Korah uses his particular role as a weapon. It is something which rankles with him, that he has a certain duty, but there is another which is, in his eyes, more important, and yet out of his reach. What does Moses say that Korah's real aim is? "Ye seek the priesthood also." There was no doubt in Moses' mind that this was all about power. It had nothing to do with whatever it was that Korah claimed. "And it is for this cause," says Moses in verse 11, "that both thou and all thy company are gathered together against Yahweh. And what is Aaron, that ye murmur against him?" Given the privileged, the sacred work of these men, given their close proximity to God, what more could they want? It was a privilege which they took for granted. It was a privilege of which they thought nothing. Mere fetchers and carriers. The sons of Aaron wrap the tabernacle, we pick it up and take it away. We put it down, we leave. Until they call us back to do some more fetching and carrying. Fetching and carrying. But what are they fetching and carrying? It is the presence of their God in the congregation. But to their mind, it is not a sacred work, but a drudge. These men were after power. They had certain responsibilities, but they were discontent with them. They saw their responsibilities not as privileged duties, but as dull, servile work, which gave them no glory. It did not satisfy their pride. Moses correctly identifies their quarrel as one with God, and not with Aaron. What is Aaron? But they murmur against him, when they are expressing directly their discontent with the role which God had given them. One of Korah's main arguments is that of holiness, and he makes much of it. He believes that all the congregation are holy, every one of them. And why is it, therefore, that Moses and Aaron have this privileged position? Why is it that the sons of Aaron only are those who are to minister in the priestly roles of the tabernacle? All the congregation is holy, he says in verse 3. And he is right. There is no doubt that this argument of Korah's is based on truth. At Sinai, God had dedicated the people of Israel to himself. He had told them that they were an holy nation, a nation of priests. This is a correct principle, but it is being incorrectly applied. It is a principle which Korah is using to his own end. How do we know this? How can we say so honestly and so defiantly almost that Korah was not concerned with holiness, but rather with power? If Korah was genuinely concerned with worshipping his God and the beauty of holiness, then firstly, would he not have been more appreciative of the work which had been given him and the tribe to which he belonged? Would he not have been more appreciative of the work of bearing the tabernacle of the congregation? But perhaps we do him wrong. Perhaps this was a man who wanted to be closer to his God. And not only closer to his God, but closer to his brethren and sisters. Perhaps he wanted to truly identify with them and draw closer to his God as a result. Perhaps he really wanted to feel like a priest. Perhaps he wanted to serve as a priest. Well, as a matter of fact, under the law there was nothing wrong with that. Moreover, under the law, there was provision made for those who were truly fervent about serving their God and wanted to dedicate their lives personally to him in a unique relationship. Men and women of whatever tribe. It was the law of the Nazarite. Was Korah so concerned with holiness? Did he really want to serve his God? If this was the case, he would have quietly taken the Nazarite vow and fulfilled it. He would have been an example to his brethren and sisters of a man who dedicated his life to God. He would have worshipped God in the beauty of holiness and sacrificed part of himself in order to serve his God. This is what Korah would have done if he really meant what he said when he said, "All the congregation is holy." It was because all the congregation were holy that the Nazarite vow was instituted. And if Korah really believed in this principle, he would have shown it by his actions. But it was not in his character to do so. The actions of Korah demonstrate a character concerned with pride and power, not with service. He was dissatisfied with the drudgery of the service of the sons of Kohath. This is not a man who would willingly have given part of his life, part of himself, to humble himself even further, to undertake the Nazarite vow. This was a man who did not want to demonstrate mastery over himself, but wanted mastery over others. Not a man concerned with the greater glory of God, but a man concerned with his own glory. On the question of holiness, Moses makes this rather pithy comment. He spake unto Korah in verse 5, and unto all the company, saying, "Even tomorrow Yahweh will show who are his, and who is holy, and will cause him to come near unto him, even him whom he hath chosen will he cause to come near unto him." Moses very carefully deals with this issue of holiness, based on a correct principle. But he makes the point that holiness is something which is imputed by God. Holiness is an imputed state based on holiness of character demonstrated by actions which are in obedience to divine command. Holiness is imputed only to those who behave in a manner which reflects the holiness of the divine character. Korah was not reflecting the holiness of the divine character. If he had been, he would have undertaken the Nazarite vow. But Moses issues a further challenge. He challenged Korah to offer incense to God. He knew this was wrong. But it would really demonstrate whether or not Korah was the man he claimed to be. In verses 6 and 7, Moses says, "This do. Take you censers, Korah, and all his company, and put fire therein, and put incense in them before Yahweh tomorrow. And it shall be that the man whom Yahweh doth choose, he shall be holy. Ye take too much upon you, ye sons of Levi." The holiness of God is something which is bestowed by God in accordance with his commandments. This was a direct test of Korah's holiness. If Korah was truly concerned with holiness, if he truly understood the commandments of God, he would have rejected such a test outright. He would have rightly answered that he had no right to do such a thing. And yet, as we see, how far from such a Christ-like attitude was the attitude of Korah. Just turn to Philippians 2. Philippians 2, verses 5 to 7. And I read this in a manner which contrasts this attitude of mind with the attitude of Korah. Philippians 2, verses 5 to 7. "Let this Christ-like mind be in you, which was also in Moses, who, being the representative of God, thought it not a thing to be grasped at to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant." But this was not the attitude of Korah. He did not have the Christ-like mind, the character of God. His holiness was a sham. To Korah, such an action as offering the incense was a thing to be grasped at with both hands. It was another rung in his ascendancy to power. Let's return to number 16. And let's see if Korah, as he suggests, and indeed as he claims, represents the entire congregation. Does he really speak on the behalf of the people and for their good? Or is he concerned with someone else? In verse 5, Moses spake unto Korah. In verse 6, he says, "Take you censers, Korah, and all his company." In verse 8, Moses said unto Korah. In verse 16, Moses said unto Korah. In verse 10, Korah gathered all the congregation. In verse 22, I beg your pardon, that was verse 19. In verse 22, Moses and Aaron ask, "Shall one man sin, Korah, and wilt thou be wroth with all the congregation?" In verse 40, the memorial is of Korah and his company. And in verse 49, the entire matter is called the matter of Korah. There is no doubt that Korah was the ringleader of this entire enterprise. It started, perhaps almost incidentally, as a personal jealousy, and developed and grew as Korah felt more and more embittered towards those whom he perceived and believed had more power than he did. Certainly there were others involved, many, many others, more than even the 250 princes. But this was really all about Korah. He didn't represent the congregation. He had no real concern for them. It was all about him. Turn to Numbers 26, in which this entire incident is recalled. Numbers 26, verses 9 to 10. The sons of Eliab, Nemuel, and Dathan and Abiram. This is that Dathan and Abiram, which were famous in the congregation, who strove against Moses and against Aaron in the company of Korah, when they strove against Yahweh. And the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up together with Korah, when that company of Korah's died. What time the fire devoured 250 men, and they became a sign. In Jude 11, we find his name mentioned once more. And we find his name mentioned in particularly poor company. Woe unto them, Jude says, speaking of those evil men. For they have gone in the way of Cain and ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward and perished in the gainsaying of Korah. The word gainsaying is a curious one. It is simply antilogia. It literally means the contradiction, the rebellion. This was the rebellion of Korah. It started with him, and it was all about him. He was not a humble man. He was not willing to serve his God and guide others in meekness. This was a matter not of holiness, but pride. Thus in Numbers 16, verse 5, Moses says, even tomorrow Yahweh will show who are his and who is holy. Yahweh will cause him to come near unto him. Even whom he hath chosen will he cause to come near unto him. It is a principle which Korah conveniently overlooked, that only those who are approved by God, who reflect his character, are permitted to come near to him. Turn to Psalm 24. Psalm 24, verses 3 to 5, we find this question posed. Who shall ascend into the hill of Yahweh? Or who shall stand in his holy place? He that hath clean hands and a pure heart, heart and hands, mind and actions, working together in holiness. No hypocrisy, a pure heart and clean hands. Who hath not lifted up his soul unto vanity, as did Korah, nor sworn deceitfully. He shall receive the blessing from Yahweh and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Moses had discerned the character of Korah and his men by comparing their actions with the word of God and the character of God, which he knew. And it was the decision of Yahweh which would determine whether or not Moses' estimation of Korah's character and that of his men was really correct. Moses sends to question Dathan and Abiram. He wants them to come to him and speak for themselves also. But Dathan and Abiram, like Korah, are not men who are interested in reconciliation. Though a brother appeal to them directly, their pride will not permit them to come. In verses 12 to 14 of Numbers 16, we read their response. It starts bluntly. We will not come up. They weren't interested in talking. They didn't want a discussion. They didn't want to sort things out. There was no reconciliation to be made. They had stated their demands and they would have them met. But have a look at the very curious statements which they make in this passage. What is their justification? We have been brought out of a land of milk and honey. Now, what did they mean by that? Moses had brought them out of a land of milk and honey. Young people, these children of Israel had only been in two significant places in the last number of years. One was Egypt, and one was Canaan. Now, either Dathan and Abiram are calling Egypt the land of milk and honey, or they are referring to Canaan as the land of milk and honey. If the former is the case, then we know very well where their minds are, still back in Egypt. Do they really think that Egypt is the land of milk and honey? Surely not. But unfortunately, if we give them the benefit of the doubt and say that they are referring to Canaan, we hardly do their characters a greater service. For they claim that Moses led them out of that land of milk and honey. Now, we do remember, do we not, that earlier, the entire congregation had come to the borders of the land. They had been urged to go in by Joshua and Caleb, Moses himself. And yet they feared and they turned around. And they would not enter the land despite the commandment of their God. Of course, when suddenly confronted with the distinctly uncomfortable alternative re-entering the wilderness, they decided to change their minds, but by then it was too late. And when they tried to enter the land without their God, they were taught that they must now bear the consequences of their actions, of their decisions. Personal responsibility. And yet here, Dathan and Abiram choose to relinquish their personal responsibility, and they claim that it was Moses who led them out of that land. Did he really? Or did he, with tears, cast himself in front of them and beg them to enter the land which their God had promised them? I think he did. And Dathan and Abiram have the presumption to blame it all on Moses and think that they can relinquish their personal responsibility before God so easily. Why would Moses do such a thing? It was apparently to kill them or to make himself a prince. This is very revealing, because it tells us something about the way these men thought. If you ask them, well, why would Moses have taken you out of a land of milk and honey? They said, it's the kind of vicious individual he is. He just wants to kill us. Oh, and he's proud too. Perhaps he wants to make himself a prince over us. Now, to anyone, these two reasons are blatantly self-contradictory. Either he wants to kill them, or he wants to make himself a prince. Unless he's particularly deranged, he wants to kill them and make himself a prince. It's hardly likely. What this really reveals to us is far less about the character of Moses, and far more about the character of these men. Why did they say that? Because had they been in the situation, that's exactly what they would have done. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. This is the kind of men we're dealing with. The kind of men who naturally gravitated to Korah. Can we not see, therefore, what his character was really like? But then, another outrageous claim. Thou hast not brought us to a land of milk and honey. Well, it's a blatant lie. He had. And they didn't like it. And when he begged them to enter, they refused. These events had not happened all that long ago. And yet, how easily was the very memory of these monumental events put out of the minds of the children of Israel by the lies of Korah and the insidious campaign of his followers. And now, a further insult. Wilt thou bore out the eyes of these men? We can see what you're up to, Moses. And what about these men who are confronting you? Are you going to take out their eyes too, so they can't see? So they'll all follow you blindly into the wilderness where you're going to kill them and make yourself a prince over them? Having taken them out of the land of milk and honey, to which you didn't bring them in the first place? A further curious contradiction. Oh no, these were men who were ungodly. I'm afraid there's no other way to say it. They did not reflect the character of God. And they finish with the same imperious, dismissive comment with which they had opened. We will not go up. These men perhaps presented themselves to their brethren and sisters as reformers, men who were courageous, who were intent on reforming the priesthood, returning the children of Israel to their God and to their land. Be very aware when anybody uses the word reform in the context of the truth. It is an excellent word if we know what it means. Historically, and indeed scripturally, reformation has always been the process by which an individual or a nation has been brought back to God by returning to those things which have fallen into neglect. There is a stark contrast between reformation and revolution. One is the returning to those things which have always been. The other is the introduction of new things which have never been before. And when the word reformation is used to disguise the word revolution, it is then that people fall into the desperate trap of departing from the ways of their fathers. Turn to Jeremiah 6, verse 16, where God makes precisely this point to the children of Israel. Jeremiah 6, verse 16. Thus saith Yahweh, stand ye in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths. Where is the good way? And walk therein. And ye shall find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk therein. This is what reform is. The command is to return to the commandments originally given. The commandments given at Sinai. Korah claimed to be doing this when he said that all the congregation were holy. A command given at Sinai. Let's reform the priesthood and return to that principle which had been established by our God at the Mount of Fire. But what else had been said at Sinai? There had also been the very clear command that the sons of Aaron were to be the sons of the priesthood. This was something which Korah obviously omitted to press. For his was not a reformation, but a revolution. The appeal of Korah, Dathan and Abiram to the principles given at Sinai only demonstrated that they were using them to justify their own purposes. And now, the judgment of God is revealed. Moses appeals directly to God to show the congregation whether or not his estimation of the character of Korah was correct. For Moses, this was not a battle between men. It was a battle between men and God. For Moses, the issue at stake, the spoil, as it were, was not the rulership, the leadership, who would have the glory, but the lives of an entire congregation. It was vital, as far as Moses was concerned, that God show the people how wrong these men were. He had revealed their true character by comparing their works with the word of God and with his character. Korah had told the people that they could approach God in the manner which they thought was acceptable, and that they did not require the mediation of the priests and the direction of Moses. He had claimed that Yahweh had spoken to them at Sinai, that he was their God, that the tabernacle belonged to them, the tabernacle of the congregation. In verses 19 and 42, God appears to the congregation. He displays his glory to them. He reminds them by his presence of what really happened at Sinai, when he revealed his glory and they could not stand before him, lest his glory consume them. the time that they removed themselves afar off and begged Moses to mediate. Now he reveals his character and his glory again, and again speaks to Moses, who is called on to mediate. All the words of Korah are exposed as self-seeking lies. For when he spoke great swelling words of vanity, he allured through the lusts of the flesh, through much wantonness, those children of Israel that were clean escaped from the Egyptians who lived in error. While he promised them liberty, Korah himself was the servant of corruption. For of whom a man is overcome, of the same is he brought in bondage. We are reminded of the words of our brother Jim on Wednesday night, that the things which we allow to control our lives will eventually dominate them. Because of his pride, Korah refused to serve. His pride controlled his life, and eventually it brought him into bondage, the bondage of death. Turn to Proverbs 16 for a rather accurate assessment of the life of Korah. Proverbs 16, verse 18. Pride goeth before destruction, and an haughty spirit before a fall. Rather appropriate given the end of Korah. But there was a lesson to be learned, and knowing the short memories of these people who only, as it were, yesterday had refused the land which God promised them, and now today were prepared to blame that failure on others, Eleazar the priest took the brazen censers as he was commanded, wherewith they that were burnt had offered, and they were made broad plates for a covering of the altar, to be a memorial unto the children of Israel, that no stranger which is not of the seed of Aaron come near to offer incense before Yahweh, that he be not as Korah and his company, as Yahweh said to him by the hand of Moses. Turn with me now to Revelation chapter 20, verses 2 and 3. In Revelation 20, verses 2 and 3, we find a complete summary of the seed of the serpent. In verse 2, we read, "The seed of the serpent, that is, the epitome of man's rebellion against God, is described as the dragon, the old serpent, the devil, and Satan." And we find every one of these elements reflected in the works of that man Korah. The dragon here represents a political system which is defiantly and rigidly opposed to God. So it was with Korah, who, when he rose up before Moses, had with him certain of the children of Israel, 250 princes of the assembly, famous in the congregation, men of renown. There was his dragon. Why the serpent? The serpent was a liar, and the lie of the serpent was, "Ye shall not surely die." Very, very recently in the history of these people, Nadab and Abihu had committed the sin of offering incense before God. Fire had gone out from them, from God, and they had been destroyed, and they died. And Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, when challenged in the same way, said, "Ye shall not surely die if you do this thing." Even though others had died previously, just a short while before, which thing they knew. Oh yes, they were the serpent, all right, and they pronounced the very same lie. Not only that, they were the diabolos. He who is a slanderer and a divider. They gathered themselves together against Moses and Aaron and said, "Ye take too much upon yourselves. Wherefore then lift ye yourselves above the congregation of Yahweh?" It was a lie and slander. God had appointed Moses and Aaron, and further, they were making the truth of God into a lie. All the congregation were holy, but not in the sense of which they claimed. And further, they were a because the other sense of the diabolos is a divider. They separated the children of Israel from their God to the extent that twice Moses and Aaron had to intercede and mediate on their behalf. And they were the Satan, the adversary of God. Moses demonstrates this very clearly. He understood the issue. Thou and all thy company are gathered together against Yahweh. If Yahweh make a new thing, and these men be swallowed up, ye shall understand that these men have provoked Yahweh. We find confirmation that Korah and his men were indeed the adversary, in the words of Jude, when he says that theirs was the contradiction, the antilogia, the rebellion of Korah against God. And he puts them in the same category as Cain and Balaam, both adversaries of God. And God made himself adversaries to them, to them all. When we read further in Revelation 20, we come to verse 3, and we find actually that this Satan in Revelation 20, verse 3, having been bound in the pit, as indeed Korah and his men were, must be loosed a little season. And so, as it were, he comes back out of the pit. And here our analogy must end, for there was no return for Korah, Dathan and Abiram. As the dragon, the diabolos, the old serpent and Satan, they were indeed cast down into the pit, but they did not return. And yet, when we return to number 16, we find that we can actually extend our metaphor derived from Revelation 20 just a little bit further. For on the very next day, incredibly, the serpent returns from the pit. On the morrow, all the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, saying, "Ye have killed the people of Yahweh." They had already forgotten the memorial which was on the altar. Why was this? Their minds had been so thoroughly prepared by the lies of Korah that they couldn't see the truth of God if it stared them in the face. These were people who had been comprehensively and systematically indoctrinated by Korah and his men over an extended duration. This was a campaign. It was not something which Korah decided to do in the morning and finished in the afternoon. In searching for the lesson for us, in talks with brethren and sisters and young people, I found that it seems to be so tempting to see this incident as an example of what happens when the arranging brethren go wrong. But in fact, it is no such thing. For the arranging brethren, as it were Moses and Aaron. This is really a what happens when the people go wrong story. The people did not know their God. As we said before, they were unfortunately ignorant. They lacked knowledge. They did not want it, because they knew it brought responsibility, and they wanted to avoid that responsibility. And even when they did have that knowledge, when they had been shown the mighty works of God, they still wanted to avoid that personal responsibility. They wanted someone to lead them, make the decisions for them, and take the responsibility. Numbers 16, verse 22, on the first instance, on the first day, as it were, Moses intercedes for the children of Israel when God is angry. Moses and Aaron both fall on their faces. They say, "O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, and wilt thou be wroth with all the congregation? Were the children of Israel on this day to be held accountable for the actions of Korah? Were they to bear the responsibility for his actions?" No. But in fact, they had already asked Korah to bear responsibility for theirs. On this first occasion, God visits judgment only on Korah and his immediate company for their actions. The congregation is spared. But God was wroth on this occasion with all the congregation, because he knew that in their hearts they shared the same thoughts of Korah, and they bore the same responsibility for rebellion as he did. The children of Israel were not mere innocent, misguided individuals who had been led astray by wicked men. They had to be taught that they had to take personal responsibility for their own actions. On this day, judgment had fallen on Korah, behind whom the children of Israel had hidden themselves and their own disobedience. But on the next day, it would be seen whether or not all the company of Korah had fallen into the pit. As we see in verse 41, there were more yet. The serpent, as it were, re-emerged from that pit. The same spirit of rebellion which was in Korah was also in the children of Israel themselves. Take Korah out of the picture, and amazingly, the rebellion is still there. He had sowed a vicious seed. And again, Moses and Aaron throw themselves before their God. They understand now very well why it was that God was wroth with all the congregation. But Yahweh says unto Moses, get you up from this congregation, that I may consume them as in a moment. They fall on their faces in appeal, and yet it is to no avail. There is no reply from God. And Moses says unto Aaron, take a censer, and put fire therein from off the altar, and put on incense, and go quickly unto the congregation, and make an atonement for them, for there is wrath gone out from Yahweh. The plague is begun. This time, Moses did not make a second appeal. Yahweh's wrath had already commenced, and it was visited on the people who were as rebellious as those men behind whom they had hoped to hide themselves. The lesson of personal responsibility was now to be taught with a very final severity. Aaron stayed the plague only by acting as a mediator, standing between the dead and the living, proving once more that the priesthood, as expressed at Sinai, was valid, and it was necessary to intercede on the people's behalf. But perhaps the lesson of personal responsibility is taught no more strongly and powerfully by those who survived. And most particularly those who survived on that first day. It is not immediately clear from the record in Numbers 16 what actually happened. But in Numbers 26 we find a better description of the events of that first day. Numbers 26 verses 7 to 11. But I read just verse 10 and 11. The earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up together with Korah. When that company died, what time the fire devoured 250 men, and they became a sign. Notwithstanding, the children of Korah died not. When Moses gave the command for all Israel to separate themselves from the tents of those wicked men, the children of Korah did so. And they were not held accountable for the sins of their father. Personal responsibility. God does not visit the sins of the fathers on the children, nor the sons of the children on the fathers. There was an opportunity for repentance. It was given and starkly refused by nearly all. These were those who had been through the whole campaign. They'd known about it. They'd never agreed with it. Perhaps they thought that there was nothing they could do. Perhaps they felt powerless. Certainly it does not seem as if they opposed Korah. Perhaps they only really understood the issues at this point. But the point was that they knew what holiness was about. They were prepared to serve their God. Before even the plague was visited upon them, before the destruction, they demonstrated the correct attitude of humility. These were not individuals who were discontent with the service of the sons of Kohath. They recognized that those who serve in the beauty of holiness must be humble, and they were not self-seeking. When Korah their father died for his pride, they did not die with him. Turn to 1 Chronicles 9, verse 19, and we see what becomes of these children of Korah. And quite suitably, in fact, entirely appropriately, we find them in a context which demonstrates their true character. 1 Chronicles 9, verse 19. And Shalom, the son of Korah, son of Abiasaph, the son of Korah, and his brethren of the house of his father, the Korathites, were over the work of the service, keepers of the gates of the tabernacle. Their fathers, being over the house of Yahweh, were keepers of the entry. A superb scriptural vindication of these men. By their humility, their willingness to accept the service which had been allotted to them by their God, they were to be given a service which involved them even more intimately with the tabernacle. They did not become priests, no. But they were brought, as it were, to the very threshold of the house of God, closer than they had ever been before, as a demonstration that in this way, by means of a pure heart, clean hands, a humble and contrite spirit, God will draw those who are truly holy to him. Those who are humble, they will dwell with him. Psalm 84, verse 10, we find, as it were, a description of the character of these men and of their thoughts. Rejecting the pride of their father Korah and his desire for power and dominion among the congregation, their attitude was one of humility and service. For a day in thy courts is better than a thousand. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. They eschewed the tents of wickedness, and so it was that they became, quite literally, doorkeepers in the house of their God. It was God who filled their thoughts. It was the service of God which motivated them. They were not men of pride, no, men of humility, whose only purpose and intent was to serve their God in the beauty of holiness, which is humility. And so God drew them to him. At the end of this chapter, we have to ask ourselves, how could this happen? And so soon, after not only the sin of Nadab and Abihu, but also the turning from the promised land. Why was it that Korah was able to drum up so much support? We can say undoubtedly that the people did what they did because they were told to, and not because they necessarily understood. But we can say also that they denied their personal responsibility, and they would not bear the yoke any more than Korah. We know that their attitude was the same as his, because when he died, the attitude did not die. And the very next day, the serpent had emerged from the pit. They had chosen to believe what they wanted, and so had to bear their responsibility for that. They could no longer hide behind Korah. Nevertheless, the foundation of God stood sure, having this seal: the Lord knoweth them that are his, and let everyone that nameth the name of Christ depart from iniquity. The sin of Korah is expressed very well in Proverbs 28, verse 10. Whoso causeth the righteous to go astray in an evil way, he shall fall himself into his own pit. But the upright shall have good things in possession. There was a possession for those who trusted in God and followed the example of Moses, despite the lying words of Korah. We can say undoubtedly that Korah would have derived far less support from the people had there been more unity among them. Pride and power are such attractive things. And when they are given to select members, offered to some groups, divisions, arguments would have only increased. Korah played very well on the men and women whom he deceived. He understood that these people, just like him, were in many ways not content. He understood that certain of them, they were not bound together in the service of their God. Possibly they did not speak together concerning their hope. They did not read together. They did not study together. They were one nation divided. We must remember, as our brother Jim exhorted us on Wednesday night, to rehearse in each other's ears the righteous acts of our God. We speak so often of having been drawn aside from the world to this place, to a unity which is based on our common hope, being knit together as those of like precious faith. The difficulty is that with our lives so sore upon us at times, with things of this world oppressing us, it is difficult when we come to this place to refocus our minds and truly see our brethren and sisters as brethren and sisters, as people sharing the same hope. When we come to this place, we need to remember that we ought to be encouraging each other, that we share the same infirmities, we share the same problems, and we need each other. Amongst other things, and in fact, above all others, we need to speak of that hope which binds us. We need to remind ourselves of that vision. I speak personally when I say that to me, the Ecclesia is my refuge in the world. I come here at the end of a week amongst ungodly company, which neither inspires me nor strengthens me. And when I come here, I need to be able to speak to my brethren and sisters, to speak of those things which truly matter, to strengthen the things which remain, and strengthen me that I might serve my God. And yet, I must confess, I speak to so few of you, so little. And that is my shame. I'll give you my reasons, just a couple of reasons. I am scared on occasion. I do not always know how to approach my brethren and sisters. I forget that they are mortals like I, and perhaps they can share my concerns. I think perhaps if I approach them, they will be offended at me attempting to share my problems with them. Perhaps if I approach them, they will think I'm being superficial, maybe self-righteous. But we should be able to leave these things aside. I do you all a disservice if I think these things. We know we are bound together by a common hope. We know we can speak to each other of that hope. I know that hope burns as brightly in you as it does in me. I truly wish that, particularly as we study together in our preparation for James, that I can grow to understand you all more fully and share with you those things which inspire me in this world, so that we might be knit together in a true unity. I need you to help me. If the children of Israel had helped each other more along the way, they would have been able to stand against the wiles of those who sought them to direct them out of the paths of God. Think of Moses. To whom did he speak? How isolated would he have been amongst his brethren, knowing that he could not always speak to them at the level he wanted? Had the children of Israel been more together, they would have sympathized with him. We really need to bind each other together with this hope. And this is the result. You know these words so well, but let's think about them in a slightly different way. This is our protection. They that feared Yahweh spake often one to another, and Yahweh hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared Yahweh and thought upon his name. And the result? Then shall ye return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, strengthening each other in this place, gives us the capacity to discern when we go back into the world at the beginning of another week and we are assailed by all that is vile and wrong. We cannot depend upon this too much, but we can use it too little. Then shall ye return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, things which the children of Israel were constantly unable to do. They followed Korah, Dathan and Abiram, because they were unable to discern between the righteous and the wicked, because they had not spoken one to another things concerning the hope which was given to them at Sinai. To discern also between him that serveth God and him that serveth him not. We all need to stand together as a unit. We truly ought to knit together by these precious promises delivered to us. I know they mean the same to you as they do to me, and I hope that I can share them with you and you with me. I need your help, and perhaps just occasionally I may be able to do something constructive for you also. We must remember our hope and the common bond which is our love of our God. The children of Israel, had they been united in their service, would never have argued who was the greater, and likewise the disciples. Had they focused on that man who was their example of service to God, followed his example as he demonstrated so clearly in the upper room, there would have been no dispute over leadership, over power and pride. Brethren and sisters and young people, let us heed these examples, remember them, and speak often one with another.